Mr. Rappel, good morning to you.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. My name is Mark Rappel, and I represent the appellant in this case, Anthony Dyer. This is a petition for further review in which we're alleging on appeal, further appeal, that the lower court abuses discretion in failing to grant Mr. Dyer probation, and the Court of Appeals erred in affirming that ruling. As the court's aware, Mr. Dyer was convicted of the offense of enticement by an electronic device, which was a Class 4 felony, and this offense happened after August 30, 2015. So the presumption of probation accompanied that particular Class 4 felony. The offense date was alleged to have occurred on November 17, 2015. However, he wasn't sentenced until August 2nd of 2016, almost 8 months later, 7.5 months later. He was sentenced to the maximum sentence of 2 years imprisonment and 12 months of post-release supervision.
You commented presumption of probation, and what is the origin of that phrase in your mind?
Well, presumption is, it may be a loose term, Your Honor, but the landscape on Class 4 felonies changed on August 30th, 2015, when the Nebraska legislature codified Nebraska Revised Statute Section 29-2204.02, subsection C, which basically directs trial courts on Class 4 felonies specifically that the court shall impose probation unless there are substantial and compelling reasons why the defendant cannot effectively and safely be supervised in the community. And so by that directive, the legislature now is directing lower courts on Class 4 felonies to say, look, on Class 4 felonies, if the person can be safely and effectively supervised in the community, you shall give them probation. So in that respect, I argue that it's a presumption of probation unless the record establishes substantial compelling reasons to believe they can't be safely supervised in the community. And it's my position, Your Honor, that if you look at the reasonings that were articulated by the trial court, very few of them have anything to do with Mr. Dyer's ability to be safely and effectively supervised in the community as required by 29-2204.02.
You just said very few. Do some of them?
I would argue none of them, Judge. The lower court articulated one reason only that would be possibly an argument that Mr. Dyer could not be safely and effectively supervised in the community. The lower
and
court
what
found...
And what was that?
That was, Judge, that the lower court found that the risk is substantial that Mr. Dyer would engage in additional criminal conduct during a term of probation. It's my position that that is a clear abuse of discretion and completely ignores the clear record in this case. If you look at the record in this case, Your Honor, the PSI indicates that Mr. Dyer had absolutely no prior criminal record, no convictions other than traffic. This case had been pending for 8.5 months from the offense date to the sentencing date. He had no subsequent law enforcement contacts and no trouble in that 8.5 month time period.
Did the pre-sentence investigation report indicate that he was at a moderate or high risk to reoffend?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Dyer did undergo an LSCMI risk assessment, and the risk assessment found him to overall be a very low risk to reoffend, very low risk to recidivate. He scored low or very low risk in 7 of the 8 domains that are listed in the LSCMI. Mm-hmm. On top of that, Your Honor, he also underwent, as part of the PSI, the Vermont risk assessment specific for sex offenders. And in that risk assessment, he also tested low risk to reoffend. On top of that, Mr. Dyer, on his own, went out and underwent a sex offender risk assessment evaluation through Dr. Giles with counseling affiliates here in Lincoln. Initially, on the static 99R, he was found to be a moderate to high risk, and then a medium risk on the stable 2007. But what's critical is that Dr. Giles, uncorroborated and uncontested by the state, concluded that those rigid risk assessments were too high, and then Dr. Giles' opinion that Mr. Dyer was actually a low risk on those two sex offender risk assessments as well. And what the court completely ignored, the court did say that he did score a moderate risk in these risk assessments, but the court only looked at it at the snapshot in time. That was before Mr. Dyer underwent 7.5 months of counseling. After 7.5 months of sex offender-specific counseling, the letters are uncontroverted. The two mental health practitioners concluded that Mr. Dyer was a low risk on all instruments to reoffend sexually. So we've got an LS3MI score of 3, which is the lowest score I've ever seen. So he's very low risk to reoffend on the LSCMI, low risk to reoffend on the FASR, lower risk to reoffend on the two instruments that the mental health professionals did. And moreover, when you look at his ability, the prediction that he's going to get in trouble again, it's just not supported by the record. The PSI concluded that Mr. Dyer did not display a criminal attitude. The PSI also concluded that Mr. Dyer did not display a pattern of generalized trouble, as evidenced by a number of things: his limited criminal history, his history of continuous long-term employment, his minimal financial concerns, his completion of high school with new behavioral issues, his positive relationship with family members, he maintained a permanent address for a sustained period of time. So all these factors seem to override the court's, what I'd say, speculation that Mr. Dyer was going to get in trouble again. He'd never been in trouble in the past. The risk assessments say he's not likely to get in trouble in the future. So where is the court's basis and in the record for a conclusion, other than speculation, that the risk is substantial that Mr. Dyer would engage in future criminal conduct?
This is, you've been focusing on the one aspect that is directed to the defendant's characteristics, right?
Correct.
Okay. And your argument is that under the, this is LB 605, that the focus is on the defendant's characteristics rather than the crime.
Yes, in terms
of safety in the community.
Yes. My reading of the statute, I think this is a statutory construction case, in my opinion. If you look at the legislative language in here, and the court must give deference to the plain and unambiguous meaning in the statute, it's unambiguous that when we're looking at substantial compelling reasons, you have to look at that through the prism of, is the defendant going to be safely and effectively supervised in the community? That's the sole focus of Class 4 felonies now, safely and effectively supervised in the community, which brings me to my next point of the other reasons the lower court articulated to deny him probation have zero to do with Mr. Dyer's ability to be safely and effectively supervised in the community. The court seemed to give great weight to the fact that a lesser sentence would appreciate the seriousness of the offense or promote disrespect for the law, the crime caused or threatened serious injury or harm.
To whom?
In that case, I don't think there was an actual victim in this case. This was an officer posing as a
young lady.
There was
lady.
No actual victim in this case, but okay. I agree with the okay. factual conclusion. But
those are statutory factors, aren't they?
Yes, Judge, but this brings me to our next point. We're talking about, and the court looked at the facts, but if you look at, the statute does give the lower court some guidance. It says courts can look at, they can look at section 29-2260, subsections 2 and 3, okay, for guidance, but it says including but not limited to the criteria listed in subsections 2 and 3 of that statute.
So one of those statutes has like A to K.
Correct.
Okay, and then the sentencing order, A to K, is an attachment.
Correct, that's right.
To the order, right?
That's right.
And things are checked off.
Right. But my position, Your Honor, is this, that if you look at, there's basically 14 total factors. There's three factors in subsection 2 of 29-2260. Those are that the risk is substantial that during a period of probation, the offender would engage in additional criminal conduct. Number two, the offender is in need of correctional treatment that can be provided effectively by commitment to a correctional facility. And number three is that a lesser would depreciate the seriousness of the offense. But if you look at those 14 factors, Your Honor, only six of them actually deal with the issue of somebody's ability to be supervised in the community. And if you look at that, the risk is substantial they'll engage in further criminal conduct. So if you look at the 14 factors, only six pertain to this clear and specific language of 29-2204.02, subsection C, and that deals with the defendant's ability to be supervised in the community.
Aren't you, in effect, arguing that even though the legislature said the trial court may consider these things, you're arguing we should interpret the statute to say no, they shouldn't consider those factors because they're contrary to the other ones?
I'm saying the language is clear. Substantial compelling reasons to be safely and effectively supervising the community. Look at those 14 factors. Only six of them address that specific issue. And you address those six and say if the other factors under Class 4 felonies shouldn't be given great weight. And I would ask to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska. The State asks this Court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals because the District Court did not abuse its discretion in finding substantial and compelling reasons to withhold probation. In State v. Baxter, this Court held that in order to comply with subsection 329-2204.2, a sentencing court should demonstrate on the record how it reached its determination that there were substantial and compelling reasons to withhold probation. The district court in this case, like the sentencing court in Baxter, stated and explained its reasoning when it pronounced the sentence by giving specific examples of information from the pre-sentence investigation report that led the court to determine that certain substantial and compelling reasons were present.
Going back to Baxter, that the state's argument is that the trial court met the statutory, performed according to the statute, if you were to read, is this your position, both the sentencing order, its attachments, and the Bill of Exceptions.
Correct.
That's how you would come to that determination.
I think it's very similar to Baxter, that when you look at the sentencing hearing, you get the examples, you get the demonstration of why the court found the substantial and compelling reasons that are then set forth in the sentencing order.
But the question, as raised in Baxter, what is the reasoning?
Right. And I think...
In your view, does all of that taken together demonstrate the reasoning, not the reasons on the checklist, but rather the reasoning?
The district court went through his reasoning at the sentencing hearing. He explained that he focused on, I think there were three main areas he focused on beyond stating his reasons. He also stated the reasons. But reasoning-wise, he focused on the circumstances of the specific offense, the serious nature of the offense. Opposing counsel points out that Dyer's initial ad on Craigslist did not seek out underage girls, but those exact communications between Dyer and who he believed to be a 13-year-old girl are contained in the pre-sentence investigation report, and the district court relied heavily on those communications. It is clear from those communications that Dyer had no problem whatsoever having sex with a 13-year-old. He was told almost immediately that he was communicating with a 13-year-old. He initiated the sexually explicit portions of their conversation, and he sent a graphic photograph of himself to this 13-year-old girl. Moreover, this did not take place over just a couple of hours. This was approximately 24-hour communication between the two. It took place over 24 hours, and he was again asked the following day if he was okay that she was 13 years old, and he said that he was. He then demonstrated that he had every intention to have sex with the 13-year-old by arriving at the agreed-upon location with multiple condoms in his possession. And he knew exactly what he was doing was wrong because his first response to police was that she told me she was 31. He then backtracked and claimed that he was planning on turning her into police. It's also understandable, and this was another reason that the district court...
I'm trying to translate circumstances of the offense into the reasoning why the defendant is not safe to put in the community.
Yes. I agree.
What did the judge say about how the circumstances of the offense yield the result that you couldn't put the defendant back in the community?
I'm not sure that I completely track you, but the judge's
reason... Well, a description of the offense is one thing, but a description of why that offense would lead to the conclusion that the defendant is not safe.
I don't know that the district court went that far. I believe that he followed Baxter in the terms that he stated he gave examples from the pre-sentence investigation for why he believed that there were substantial compelling reasons that this defendant would engage in criminal conduct again. Now, this case happened pre-Baxter, and I think the district court did the best that it could at the time to try to comply with the
Right, and the attachment to the sentencing order effectively attracts the statute.
It does,
A to K and a few more at the top. Okay.
And I believe if you read the sentencing hearing, he attempted to demonstrate his reasoning. Now, did he exactly say, this is what I find, and therefore I believe this reason? I don't know, but I do think he did as much as the court did in Baxter, which the court said was enough to demonstrate his reasoning on the record.
And the other things that he said at the sentencing hearing track the customary deprecates of seriousness of the offense and so forth, which, although as Justice Castle points out, are statutory factors, they're not new.
They're not new.
And what is the relationship between the old and the new sketch?
I think the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that a sentencing court is still required under 29-2260 to take into consideration the nature and circumstances of the crime and not just the elements of the crime charge, but the specific circumstances of the crime.
Wouldn't it be extraordinary not to have a sentencing judge take that into consideration, have to read or construe the statute to take that out as a factor altogether?
Yes,
this is the customary script for decades.
Right.
Some
and
of
I
us
believe,
are older. But I'm going to the chief's question.
Yes.
The question, what's the statute, the new statute, how does that inform the sentencing decision in addition to the historical factors?
I think what this court explained in Baxter is that now the new statute kind of tips in the favor of probation, but yet at the same time, it points us to the factors that have long been held. This is what sentencing courts need to consider. I don't think this went away. I don't think you can ignore this language like opposing counsel wants this court to do. You have to consider the nature and the circumstances of the crime and go through those factors found in 29-2260. So I don't think it takes any of those original considerations away, and that it wants the court to explain further, like was explained in Baxter. If the court can't articulate why it's withholding probation, then maybe it should impose probation. And I do think, obviously, you know, one of the most explicit examples, I mean, the legislature specifically said prior failures at probation is not good enough. So that's their clear intention, is they want the court to look beyond just have you failed in the past, but look to the other circumstances set out in 2260.
With respect to the reasoning of the trial court judge, the judge discussed the historical circumstances of these particular actions by the defendant.
Yes.
He also talked about how that those actions would affect a victim.
Yes.
What may be troubling some is that he's in essence has the two components of a syllogism, but he doesn't specifically pronounce the connection of the two. A and B, therefore C.
Right.
Got A and B expressly pronounced, but he didn't say therefore
yes.
C.
Right.
And you don't think that's a problem?
I don't think it's a problem. I think, like I said, this happened pre-Baxter. I think this court has now given sentencing courts more guidance and what needs to be done. I do think the court attempted to explain his reasoning of why he believes probation should be withheld in this case.
Assuming that the trial court pronounced A and B, is there any other reasonable conclusion other than the C that's implicit?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And with respect to the effect on the victim?
Yes.
How does that relate to the crime in this case?
Well, I think the court was just looking at...
I mean, there is no 13-year-old young...
Right. He was just looking at the intentions of the defendant. Uh-huh. The defendant intended to have sexual relations with a 13-year-old. So he was looking at it through the defendant's eyes, if this would have actually meant reality as opposed to a law enforcement officer. And that was his concern. And he also focused on...
I mean, there's no... In this particular event, there's no... traumatized victim.
Right.
Okay.
Right. He also focused on some of the testing with the sex offender risk assessment valuation. The defendant scored in the moderate high category, meaning that over 74% of the offenders scored lower than he did on the test. And I think that the district court, based on that finding, was free to reject the expert's ultimate.
Because opposing counsel lists a whole bunch of other tests and information and counseling and so forth that might be inconsistent with that.
Yes.
And but your point is the judge can pick the one that he or she thinks is persuasive.
Yes, can I have one more second?
You may.
He told Dr. Giles that he doesn't know if he would have followed through and actually had sex with her if he was a girl. Like he hoped, he believed that he could have done the right thing, but he wasn't sure. So I think When you read the entire evaluation, I understand why the district court was somewhat skeptical with the ultimate.
Thank you.
And we ask that you affirm the judgment of the court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute.
1 minute, Mr. Rappel.
Your Honor, this case is way distinguishable from Baxter. Baxter, this court articulated several reasons why that defendant could be safely and effectively supervising the community. His probation had been revoked 3 times. He was a maximum risk for drugs, violence, and antisocial tendencies. He was ordered to get an evaluation 3 months before sentencing. Didn't do it. He didn't appear for his PSI appointment. He didn't appear motivated to participate in supervision. Compare that to Mr. Dyer. He cooperated with the PSI. He didn't violate any of his bond conditions. Probation office noted no barriers to completing probation successfully. Probation office noted no barriers to him not be unfavorable toward convention. Probation office importantly had no concerns regarding Mr. Dyer's attitude towards supervision and treatment. This is distinguishable from Baxter. Again, focus on the language of the statute, substantial compelling reasons beyond the community of mind. Last point would be, if the legislature didn't want these types of crimes, although serious, to be class 4 felonies, they know how to reclassify these as class 3A felonies. They've done it multiple times prior to 605. Strangulation, terroristic threat, second degree sexual abuse of an inmate or a parole. They've reclassified those as class 3A felonies, which in my opinion means now you can focus more on those other things, the facts underlying the charge, the seriousness of the offense. But by carving out a class 4 felony, if I may finish, the legislature sent a clear directive, although a serious crime, the presumption of probation should apply unless there's substantial compelling reasons to believe he can't be effectively supervising the community. There's nothing in the record that says he cannot be safely and effectively supervised. So we ask the court to reverse the sentence.
What was the evidence that the defendant was at risk to reoffend?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What was the evidence that the defendant was at risk to reoffend if he were given probation and not?
Judge, there's zero evidence that he's at risk to reoffend. All the risk assessments, if you look at his past, he has no criminal history. And if you look at attempts to predict his future, which no one can do with certainty, but these instruments are validated, they're statistics behind them. All the validated risk assessments told this court, the sentencing court, that moving forward, the risk is low that this person is going to reoffend. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Our next